And Lil got the an order that his half brother, who was head geneticist of their colony, of their group, Enki, to do that. So Enki finally accepted. Well, he had no choice. You know, he was geneticist. He wasn't at the head of the command, but he was a scientist and he was very curious. So he started to just, look into that. And that's when he discovered and he changed his mind. And he said, oh my God, the potential in these ones, there's so many different intergalactic DNAs in these ones. They're not going to be slaves. I'm going to do something that secretly I'm going to try to develop their potential and save them. So that was the start of Big Troubles.
You are listening to Exopolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala, your source for the uncensored truth regarding the human, extraterrestrial, global, and political agenda. Click the like button and subscribe to this channel. And now, here's Dr. Michael Sala.
Well, I'm delighted to welcome Elena Danam back to Exopolitics Today, who's just finished and has released her new book, The Seeders Today. So welcome, Elena.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you very much. It's a great day for me.
Indeed it is. It's the equinox, and you chose today to release The Seeders. And this book, I did read an advanced copy of it, and it really is astounding, amazing information in there. So I have a lot of questions, and maybe you can give people an idea of some of the contents of the book. It's so rich, but I just wanted to kind of like through this interview give you a chance to give people an idea of what's in it.
Well, thank you, Michael. Well, what's in it? It's my encounters. It's narrated from my perspective of my encounters with the Intergalactic Confederation arriving in our star system in late October 2021, and also different encounters I've had with other beings. So the period of changes that has happened from September 2021 to September 2022, it has been an amazing period of changes with a lot of different beings arriving in our star system. And I am writing all about this, and it is also about memory retrieved, not only my memory from where I come from really, but what is important is the memory of the true history of Earth, and that is quite important.
Indeed, it's very important. If we can get an idea of who were the different extraterrestrial civilizations that helped seed our planet or establish the human genome on our planet. So you talk about the seeders, and you talk about the 24 civilizations, and you talk about the Intergalactic Confederation. So can you just explain who they all are? Is it all just one and the same?
The Intergalactic Confederation is a gathering of an amazing number of cultures from several galaxies. There's a lot of galaxies involved and so many cultures. Imagine in our only galaxies on how many cultures are in the Galactic Federation of Worlds. But at intergalactic level, it's huge, the number. I don't know how they count that. It must be amazing. Well, that's the Intergalactic Confederation. It's like a super federation that is above all the others, just the galactic ones. These people, Intergalactic Confederation, they have a group within themselves, which is called the Seeders. So the Seeders are part of the Intergalactic Confederation. Who are they? They are 24 cultures, extremely advanced. And these 24 cultures gathered in a sort of a groupment that they call themselves the Seeders of the founders, but the Seeders is really embodying what they do and who they are, they assist the great work of Source to spread out life throughout the universe. They recognize the higher management. Well, management, it's not really a word appropriate, but it depicts a bit the idea of 9 supraconsciousnesses. And these 9 supraconsciousnesses are not part of anything, but they are at the root of the structure of the universe. We can talk about it later. So this is who are the seeders.
So they are kind of like connected to this intergalactic confederation. And the seeders played, you mentioned 24 civilizations as well. So can we say that the seeders are, there's 24 civilizations or cultures making up the seeders?
Yes. Yes, that's correct. Yes.
Great. Okay. So now, how were they involved in the establishment of different civilizations on Earth? I mean, we know of Hyperborea. Herodotus talked about Hyperborea, and Plato talked about Atlantis. So how were the seeders involved with those two civilizations?
Well, the seeders, they have been involved in the development of humanity since about 65 million years. It's really been a long history. They arrived, they did a little bit of work and attendance, and they went away. They came back, they went away. So that they done that the whole time, come and back. And at the time where Hyperborea was existed, it's Hyperborea is a civilization that grew from, mainly we can say it's the Earth people who have really gathered into making in Northern Hemisphere a civilization that was quite quite advanced. They were very in tune with different people and races of animals who have since migrated to inner Earth. So Hyperborea was like, you imagine Tolkien or these epic settings, you know, where people have quite of a civilization, but magic is there everywhere, and they're very in tune with their environment and with the universe. So these people, the Hyperboreans, had interaction, commercial interaction with Atlantis, and they even migrated at the end of their civilization to Atlantis. And Atlantis was founded by a specific culture, part of the seeders, who are the Altians. And the Altians, they are the most interactive with us. They have still now 2 bases on Earth and a few in the star system. And they are the closest, you know, humanly speaking, to us. So they founded Atlantis, and they found this continent fragmented in many islands in the middle of the Atlantic, and they settled there. They built a colony. They brought their technology there, and they welcomed many colonies of humans, and the Hyperboreans were part of them, one of these colonies.
Now, one of the other races or civilizations that were involved in the founding of humanity is the Anunnaki. And we know from ancient texts, from Sumerian texts, that the Anunnaki were involved in the creation of the human genome. And according to the Sumerians, as far as they know from what they were told, the Anunnaki are humanity's forefathers. But with the information about the seeders, it seems that the Anunnaki, were they actually part of the seeders group, or were they something else? Were they like conducting a separate genetic experiment to what the seeders were doing?
So the Anunnaki are not part of the Intergalactic Confederation. They are from Nataru, this galaxy, Milky Way. They live on a different dimensional plane, but they are from here. So they're not part, and they are not part of the Cedars. And they came, they had an input, a very significant input in the development of human genome on Earth. But the thing is, when the Anunnaki arrived, we more or less know the story. They found Earth and they wanted to mine resources. One of the resources they were mining was gold. There was a lot of gold on Earth. And they saw these humans, these primitive humans. They were already humans, but more primitive than now. And they decided to upgrade them, mixing them with their own biology, their own genome, to create a race of hybrids that they could use as slaves. But when the Anunnaki started to this process, they discovered that these humans were already the fruit of another experimentation from other people, the Intergalactic Confederation. So they came afterward, the Anunnaki came afterwards and made their input into the development of human, but they were not the first.
Well, we know that according to some geneticists that human DNA is very similar to the DNA of chimps. And so chimpanzees have, 48 chromosomes, humans have 46 chromosomes. But we have, the chimps have two extra chromosomes, but we have the same two extra chromosomes, but they've been fused together. And some authors say that that's a result of a genetic experiment or intervention by extraterrestrials many millennia ago. So would that have been something that the Cedars had done? You know, you mentioned millions of years ago that the Cedars were here. They began doing the genetic experiments. They created some intelligent species or groups. And then much later on, the Anunnaki arrive and they found, okay, here are these humans, or these primates, but they weren't like the chimps. These primates that the Anunnaki began working with were presumably like, they had 46 chromosomes. They were maybe, I don't know, Neanderthals or Cro-Magnon man or something. So it seemed that there was a progression of different human primitive societies, and that the Cedars began, with the chimps, right, and then created primates, and then the Anunnaki come along and co-opt all of that. So you want to just elaborate?
Yes, well, the Patal, who are also a name for the Cedars, Patal are a race on their own, but they gave their name to the 24 Cedars. We can say they are the Patal as well because they created the group, in fact. So these, the Patal or the Cedars, they took a very primitive, a chimp, but it was before chimp, even before an animal that was into to develop a chimp. This little animal was taken as virgin ground for their experiment. They wanted to implant the human genome into this little animal and let nature develop with time. You know, they have all that time. So what they were doing, they were coming and putting a little bit of modifying a little bit the DNA of the very primate, and then they would let the law of evolution unfold. And when it will be all satisfactory, they will come back and put a little bit more. So it will be smooth and follow the laws of evolution, you know. And the environment would develop and change also. So they would adapt to the environment. So that was done scientifically, like an experiment that you just watch and, you know. But the Anunnaki had other plans. They didn't want to do that for science, you know. The first idea of the project was by the military commander of the group, whose name was Enlil, and he wanted to use these primates. Well, because when they arrived, they had brought with them their own workers, but the workers rebelled and went away. So Enlil had this idea to use these very curious primates, and well, not primates anymore, they were early humans, and they had already behavior like humans. They were very curious, apparently. So the Anunnaki called them the black heads, because they had black skin and very dark big hair. And that's very interesting, because that gives a track to the genetics of who these early humans were. And they used them, but Enlil wanted to speed up a development by violent hybridization, to speed up this development, to have fast results. And that was against the law of evolution. So Enlil got an order that his half-brother, who was head geneticist of their colony, of their group, Enki, to do that. So Enki finally accepted. Well, he had no choice. You know, he was geneticist. He wasn't at the head of the command, but he was a scientist and he was very curious. So he started to look into that. And that's when he discovered, and he changed his mind. And he said, oh my God, the potential in these ones, there's so many different intergalactic DNAs in these ones. They are not going to be slaves. I'm going to do something that secretly going to try to develop their potential and save them. So that was the start of Big Troubles.
Right, so that's very important that there was this disagreement amongst the Anunnaki themselves over the humans that were created and how they would be used and exploited. And obviously this is something that we can talk about a little bit later when it comes to their return. But right now, as far as the Anunnaki themselves are, and their genetics, I mean, you talk about them as being hybrids themselves of the Nebu and of Sirius B humans. So can you describe that?
Yes, there was. It was way, way before the Nebu rose as a power in the Orion Zone. It was way, way before there were races of greys, tall greys there already, Betelgeuse, Rigel, and all this Mintaka. And there was a conflict with Sirius B, who were humans, populated by humans. Sirius B star system is extremely populated. There are many civilizations in there. It's a hub for life, technology. A lot of things are happening in Sirius B system. So there was a conflict, and to resolve the conflict, there was a hybridization to create a new race, and who were the Anunnaki. And the Anunnaki have more human DNA than gray. So they consider themselves human. And you know, they call themselves Syrians as well, from Sirius B, Tashkeru also. They consider themselves by proud of the human. They prefer to consider themselves as humans than grays. So they say they are from Sirius B.
So can you tell us about the Sumerian kings list, and how important is that in terms of understanding the involvement of the Anunnaki in the creation of humans and subsequent ruling bloodline families?
So that is a very interesting fact and artifact, because we found that on clay tablets. There is a corroboration in ancient Egypt with the Zeptepi period, which is also written down. What is that about? When two civilizations tell the same thing, there's something to fall. There's a track there that you cannot dismiss. What is that about? Both say that in immemorial times in the past, there was there were gods coming to Earth, and that these gods rule over Earth. But dates are given, and the rulership is like sometimes 1,000 years rulership. That's not human, you know. And we know that the Anunnaki live very long. Well, I know. The Sumerian king list details the rulership of gods. They give names everywhere they ruled, changes of places with thousands and hundreds of years of reign, and suddenly there's a change. They hybridize themselves with humans, and then there are human hybrid kings. There's a list of hybrid kings, and then you see the length of the reigns a little bit shorter, and then one day the gods leave the planet and leave the custody of the planet to totally human kings with normal length of reigns and life. So that is really telling, and dates are given. And when these dates correspond to the dates given by the Egyptian, ancient Egyptian records, that is amazing.
It is, and those ancient records are very important for us understanding a little bit about the culture and the dynamics of the Anunnaki and some of the other groups. Because we don't know too much about the cedars, but we know a lot about the Anunnaki because the Sumerians talked about them. And I mean, we don't know too much about Atlantis other than Plato talking a little bit about it historically. So the Sumerian records and the Egyptian records. Now, the Egyptian gods, are we talking the same? Are we talking about a similar group to the Anunnaki, or are we talking about something else altogether?
So that is that was a really a clarification for me, because that was very blurry and messy. The Egyptian, the ancient Egyptian culture was an offshoot from the Anunnaki. It was an Anunnaki colony, and they started to rule themselves upon this area of the world, and then exactly what is written in the Sumerian king list, it's written in the Zeptepi list in Egypt. They ruled over the land. Then they put hybrids in power, and then it cut, and it was only human kings. Exactly the same. So the Egyptian gods, there's something very interesting. The Pyramid of Unas, 3100 something BC, Pyramid of Unas in Saqqara. So that predates the pyramids of Giza. In this pyramid, there are texts written, well, carved and painted inside of the pyramid. And it's called the Text of the Pyramids, and it depicts a star religion. It's the first time, the oldest text have that depicts the gods and the Ennead. The Ennead is 9 ruling gods. So that's when it becomes interesting for 2 aspects. The number 9, in Egyptian counting and spirit, 9 means multitude. Okay, so it can represent a multitude of gods, but that wouldn't, you know, fit totally with it. It wouldn't make sense. What makes sense is that the number 9 is also the number for the 9, these supraconsciousnesses who are in the void, at the root, at the singularity of all universes, all dimensions, to whom the Intergalactic Confederation and the Cedars relate as a higher guidance. So the Anunnaki, you know, they were a very advanced civilization. And at a stage in the development, you become aware of where you stand in a universe and how the universe is structured, and you are aware of source as an origin of consciousness and life energy, and also you become aware of the nine principle of the universe, these mysterious supraconsciousnesses. So of course the Anunnaki knew about the nine. So they brought also with them this awareness. There's a confusion, you know, between this awareness of the nine and the Anunnaki being remembered as gods. So nine gods. There were more of them, but the number nine, it's divine for the ancient Egyptian, represents the god, the nine. The Anunnaki left a heritage of this spirituality. You know, 3,000 years, you have the time to get confused because you pass from generation to generation. History becomes myth becomes religions, and it just becomes really weird. The ancient Egyptian gods at the start were Anunnaki custodians. And through the story of Seth and Osiris, you find the struggle between Enlil and Enki for the inheritance of the land and for the bloodline that will give the bloodline of the kings. And the bloodline of the kings came from Osiris, Uzir. Wazir means the powerful, the Lord. And this really, really, really reminds us of Enki as fathering a royal bloodline. But it doesn't mean that Enki was Osiris. No, you know, there are many different gods that can represent the same aspect or ancient ET, you know, it's very complex. But just to say that the struggle between Osiris and Seth was an ancient reminiscence of the custodian war between Enki and Enlil.
Yes, that is very interesting. And, you know, we have other cultures also having similar battles between brothers, you know, like, of course, we have Thor and I've forgotten his name, but how can I forget his name? But Thor's opposite in the in the Norse mythology
Loki was the tricky one. And what's interesting with Loki in the Norse mythology, Loki plays God. Loki plays roles. And Loki is the opposite of Thor. Thor, when you look at the meaning of it, means the chief of armies or the one in command. But it's more of a title of, it's not really military. It's like Lord would mean Lord, or, you know, the noble one who is at the head. And so yes, Loki played a lot games. And we find in the inheritance of the Anunnaki story, which is in the Hebraic tradition, there's a god there's a custodian ET that plays God, and that is very tricky, and that always likes to turn humans one against them the other, and always try to make them fight and play tricks on them and order slaughters. Loki was doing that, but in the Hebraic tradition, it was Enlil. And so everything, you know, we need to look at these things with a global vision, planetary vision, and follow all the myths together And then we understand, having a broader perspective. You know, you cannot take one culture's mythology and say, that's it. No, you'll have to look all over the world and see the correspondence. Then you can find who was who, you know?
Yeah, very interesting, these parallels, these myths of our brothers, half-brothers fighting against each other and they being part of the kind of like creator gods. I mean, also you have Zeus and Poseidon, and so it kind of repeats from culture to culture. Well, yes. One of the things that I find very perplexing, and maybe you can clarify, is exactly what role did the Anunnaki play in Atlantis? On the one hand, the Atlanteans were the seeders or founders or connected to the founding of Atlantis, but at the same time, the Anunnaki were involved with Atlantis. So yeah, can you describe what the Anunnaki involvement with Atlantis was?
Yes, the Anunnaki were there before the Altean colony came back to found the civilization of Atlantis that they called Atla. Before that, this continent was already taken by the Anunnaki, you know, and Enki had set his residence there for a while. And that's why Enki is linked to Poseidon and is the waters, but it's also something else with the waters and Enki. The waters represent the genetics, the genetics is the water of creation, the liquids of anyway. Then there was this war. Enki wasn't linked to Atlantis anymore, and the Altaeans came, they took the land, they were there. Enki and his faction lost the war against Enlil. You know, Enki is not a military chief. He loves life. He's a lover of life. He's a poet. He's a scientist, you know. So he's not good at fighting. So he left. But Enlil stayed longer on Earth, left a descendants and a faction that is still here today. And these people, the people of Enlil, had a part to play in the fall of Atlantis. You know, they allied with reptilians who arrived also at the same time in these times. And they worked together because they had the same mind, which is to collapse a society from the inside, to infiltrate it, to hybridize with the ruler class. And then once you're in, you collapse it by internal wars. That's what happened. So that was the involvement of the Anunnaki in Atlantis that I know.
So the Sons of Belial, Edgar Cayce talked about the Sons of Belial infiltrating and taking over Atlantis and bringing about its destruction. So yeah. By the Sons of Belial, we're talking about this Enlil faction,
yes,
that really just undermined Atlantean civilization out of jealousy, out of spite, because this was an Altean colony that had taken over what was earlier Anunnaki territory.
Yes, the Altaeans were not easily corruptible, you know, but because they had quite a strong mind and were very advanced in consciousness, very quickly what happened when the infiltration started, because, you know, Atlantis was growing in power, and this power, everybody else wanted it. So everyone wants to be part of Atlantis. Also, the colonies, you know, was very strict, and because the Altaeans have a technology that is quite powerful and used at wrong ends can be extremely destructive. But when you have this technology, you have the ultimate power, and they all wanted it. So Atlantis was coveted by or, you know, these Anunnakis and reptilians also were there. They infiltrated, yes, and they worked on the colonies. What happened is that there's a shift that happened between the Altean class of scientists and the colonies. And there were really crack. And when it started to smell bad, because the colonies wanted the power, they wanted to have access to the generators and the crystal technology and everything. So it started to smell bad. So the Alteans decided to go and preserve this knowledge out of Atlantis throughout the world.
That is fascinating, because again, in Atlantis, we have this theme of where you have one faction comprising scientists that are more humane and wanting to preserve the culture, whereas on the other hand, you have this power faction that is there to try and control everyone and suppress. And there was a split in Atlantean society. And that seems to have been the same in Anunnaki society. And so it yes. does make me think that maybe the, some of those have been localized of this Enki faction, whatever part of it remained, if any of it remained after Enki had to leave.
Yes, for sure. You know, Enki wasn't on his own. He had his people with him, you know. So these people certainly stayed in Atlantis, yes. But the Alteans were in control, but there were Anunnaki there as well, working and being with the Alteans.
So now we kind of come forward. I mean, all of this happened, we're talking about, say, 9,700 BC. So we're talking roughly 11,000, nearly 12,000 years ago, and that's kind of like historical records show that this is around the time Atlantis collapsed, and Plato talked about it as happening 9,600 BC. So, nearly 12,000 years, Atlantean society collapses, and the Cedars played a role in the establishment of the Atlantean society or civilization. So now here we are in the present moment. The Cedars return. They returned en masse in October of 2021. So why did they return now? Why is this period of time so important that they would return after such a long hiatus from their last presence on Earth?
Because it's the return when a great evil had left this star system, cast away by the Alliance, which is the Galactic Federation of Worlds, the Andromedan Council, all these benevolent ET factions, who, with the help of the Earth Alliance and the Martian Alliance as well, and the Ashtar Command, the good one from Jupiter, they managed to get the Greys, the Nebu Greys, and the Reptilians out of the star system. They're still outside, they're still there, try to get in, but they won't. So once the star system was safe and free, wasn't at war anymore, the Intergalactic Confederation came back. Why now? Why didn't they come and took part of the war? Because, you know, they are 20,000 years in advance on us technologically. And in consciousness as well. They are aware that all civilization need to walk their own path of evolution. And this is also worth for the Galactic Federation of Worlds. And they allowed everyone here to stand up for themselves, regain their sovereignty, and find the strength and the motivation and the hope to finally break their chains. Nobody was supposed to come to save us. Keep an eye, just if something bad happened, they just, you know, protect us. But they want us to do the job. They want us to free ourselves And that's what has happened. You know, all these programs that have been set up together in cooperation with the Federation and the Galactic Federation, and for instance, Solar Warden or the Earth Alliance, that was all to build our defenses and our forces that we as Earth people free ourselves. So militarily speaking, the bad ETs have gone. So now there was one more thing to do, is for the humans of Earth to stand for themselves, the civilians, and just, you know, stand and say no to tyranny and etc. And the Cedars, they came back to see that for what we can call a graduation, you know. They came back because it is time, now that the bad ETs are gone, it is time we can finally learn about who we are. And they come for that, and with the knowledge and with the technology that now will not fall into the wrong hands because it is safe. So now we are going to have access to this technology.
So the Cedars are returned, and and that's because the Earth, or what they can see, I mean, obviously we're talking about beings that are able to see into the future. And so they see us as a liberated planet. Now, of course, we're in the midst of the process still. You know, we know that some of the, we know that the VTs, the Draco and the Orion Greys, that they have left, but that still their former minions are here and have a lot of power and are playing havoc. So, and people, and that's one of the questions I often get is like, well, you know, you and Elena talked about these agreements that were reached in Antarctica, and that the leaders of the Dark Alliance agreed to leave the planet and go to some other planet that had been arranged for them by the Cedars, but we're still seeing all of this trouble. So, you know, who left and who remained? I mean, the people that remained, are they still causing the problem? I mean, they're obviously causing the problem. So, yeah, can you just add on that?
Yes. Who left? The extraterrestrial threat, the Nebu and the Sikar Empire, they left. The human minions of these people are still here. And the deal in Antarctica was that you collaborate to the change, you give us the keys of your financial system, and you collaborate for a smooth transition, and we allow you to leave. But didn't really happen like this. Apparently, they tried to trick. They tried to trick the baddies, they tried the dark humans, they tried to trick. Imagine trick these guys. Good luck, you know. So they're not leaving for the moment. It's going in a bad way for them because they decide to chance it. Because there's so much at stake, you know. They decide to chance it and not cooperate and try to play their last cards that they still had in their bag, to try to get the Earth back. So now the Intergalactic Confederation and the Federation of Worlds, they are enticing us to really stand for ourselves, and they are giving them warnings. Now, do not give in to fear narratives. They are playing their last cards. They are planning. They are trying to put in action a very old agenda that they had. It was their last card, the alien invasion or salvation. There was also something that was planned, was a holographic show, amazing holographic show, making us believe that there is a dramatic, catastrophic solar event that is going to destroy everything on Earth. But that's all this. They want to play this, chance it, you know. I don't think that, I don't believe, as these guys upstairs, they don't believe either that it will go to term, because humans know. I mean, the, you know, we know now that it's going to be a trick.
That is definitely an important issue of exactly what is going to be the final card or cards that the deep state plays to keep their power in the face of these incredible galactic events that are unfolding around us. Now, in Indigenous traditions, there's descriptions of the return of the gods, and you actually in the book, in the Cedars, talk about the return of the gods. So can you explain how that connects with Indigenous traditions, you know, Hopi and Mayans and other Indigenous peoples around the world believing that the creator gods will return?
This is a worldwide myth and prediction. And this is, it's like these people were told the future. And they knew about it, that someday after a terrible period of war, there would be a war after a terrible period of, I mean, slavery and dark ages, who last extremely long, like all our history, in fact, since the Anunnaki. One day there would be a final battle between dark and light, and the dark, the beast of the dark, would lose. And there would be peace afterwards. But in this process, there would be reveal of the dark. And that's the most painful, you know, when you need to press a wound and let everything out. And then the gods of the light would come back, and for this moment, to help reveal the dark. Apocalyptin means the reveal of the light. Apocalypse, it's not a dramatic event. It means the reveal of the light. So that's very telling. So you find this, yes, the Hopi, you find this in many traditions. And, you know, you have also in the Himalaya, this tradition. I was impressed to discover that as well and learn about the Kala Chakra, the wheel of times. That's amazing. They describe this as well, that the gods, after a great evil, would come from under the earth and being outside and fight with the gods who would return in their silver ships. And then there would be the victory of the gods, or the good ones, and there would be peace, long period of time afterwards. And that is the Kala Chakra was a discovery for me when I start to research for this book. For, you know, it really depicts the enslavement of the mind, the mind control that's happening. And that was written from, you know, Buddha had this text. So, you know, it came from a very, very long time ago. And there's so many traditions in the world. So this, everybody knew. And you know what? It's happening now. And it's exciting.
Yeah, it is very exciting. And I know Indigenous peoples, I mean, they keep their traditions pretty pure, and from generation to generation, they're handed down. Yeah. So they do describe this return of the creator gods, the beings that help establish them or their presence on Earth. Now, on the other hand, we have organized religion. And organized religion, they don't talk about the return of the gods. They talk about the second coming. And, you know, so can you kind of like just describe a little bit about the second coming and how that is such an important part of organized religion?
Yes. So organized religion, that's something that developed from the I would say, the Enlil part of the heritage of the Anunnaki. They left, the Enlil and his faction have been remaining on Earth. Enlil, not Enlil himself, but his representatives and the bloodlines that he bred himself into. they develop a system of control. Jesus was completely hijacked. Jesus was, as I explain in my book, a descendant from royal bloodline that was very positive, opposed to Enlil, and he was bringing a message of empowerment, peace, and unity by love. And he had to be, you know, when he had to be neutralized. When you cannot kill someone who's influential because you would make his message more credible even. So what you do, you hijack the message and you discredit the person or either hijack the message. You couldn't discredit Jesus. He was too powerful in the minds of so many people. So they hijacked his message and they create all the, you know, in Rome, not to name it, all this powerful institution. And it became they selected very specific text to form a testament that would be the guideline for control and power. And this gave the religions of the book. That is something that just came like lead on the top of all the ancient patriarchs and their beautiful messages to just put a lid on it and now control. And the organized religions have been controlling mentalities of so many people and cultures throughout recent history. And the second coming, you know, they came up with that to counteract the predictions of the traditional indigenous people that announced wonderful gods who come and, you know, help us to overcome the dark. They couldn't remove these ancient myths. So what this institution of the organized religions do, and as a Druid myself, I know well of the subject, they reassign the mythical figures, they reassign them and they redress them at their, you know, their own recipe to create a version that is going to confuse people for a while, and then they forget about the old version and they adopt the new one generation after brainwashing, you know. And then the old messages, the old history has gone. It's forgotten. It's been just, you know, hidden and kept away. And now it's about controlling people for power. And that's what the organized religions do. And so reassigning the coming of the positive gods into a coming of destructive gods and destructive ETs. I mean, you know, it's going to be horrible and et cetera, et cetera. And there's also, that goes even further, the second coming of Jesus. That is so well put together because they probably plan to manipulate people with that. That if someone comes and says, oh, I'm Jesus, I'm back, or even a hologram, people are going to fall on their knees. All these millions of people who have been groomed for generations and generations, they are going to fall on their knees and just obey. Well, that's that as well.
Well, that's very interesting, what you mentioned about Jesus and the second coming and that being part of a kind of contrived, organized religion version of the second coming. Because I know Stuart Swerdlow, I interviewed him, and he described an incident where he was sent back in time from the Montauk Project back to the crucifixion. And his first assignment was to murder Jesus. And he said he couldn't do it. He failed. It just didn't happen. So he was sent back a second time. And his second mission was to just get some of the blood of Jesus.
Yes.
And then he brought it back. And he learned that they then used this blood to clone a fake Jesus. So they could manufacture a second coming with Jesus, using a cloned Jesus, using his original blood, but they would actually sell this to humanity. And the thing is that they would sell it to Christians, by saying, well, you know, we have the Shroud of Turin, which is actually the garb that was over the body of Jesus, you know, when he was dying, he was wrapped in it. And they can extract some of the DNA from that and compare it to this clone, and you have a match, and all of a sudden, you know, there you have scientific confirmation that this is Jesus.
Yes, it's about the blood, you know, and the, you know, there is something, because I've been raised as a Christian, so I used to go to mass also, so I learned, and I love to learn. I was very curious, you know, when this thing with the blood, the sharing of the blood, my blood, this is my blood given for the multitude. What does that mean? You never, nobody ever tries to understand what does it mean. The blood of Jesus given for the multitude, that is his descendants. Goes back, and I speak about it in my book, to Enki. And this bloodline has tremendous power.
Well, the blood is a very important element here. And you mentioned earlier the bloodline of Jesus, the authentic Jesus, that he did actually establish. Yes. Successors and the marriage to Mary Magdalene and the children that they gave birth to. Now, this bloodline of Jesus, now he did go through a virgin birth. So his blood actually seems to be not so much that, well, put it this way, his blood is connected to one of the cedar races, the Hoover race, according to some of the literature. I know the Only Planet of Choice with Phyllis Schlemmer, she talks about the Hoover civilization as giving birth to Jesus. So is that really what the bloodline connection to Jesus is, that this pure bloodline is connected to this, you know, to Jesus, but also to Mary, to his mother Mary, and to the Altians, or Hoover, if you like?
Yes, so that's very interesting, because Jesus has two strands of bloodlines, from the father and from the mother, of course. And Mary had the Anunnaki strand, and his father was from another powerful bloodline. And this is probably when we go into the track of the Intergalactic Confederation. And this, the mix of the two, the both, is like explosive. It's like, you know, incredible. So Mary it was not a virgin birth. She was abducted. I mean, you know, when this tall blonde person beams into a room and says, oh, you're going to be pregnant, and there's a big flash of light. I mean, that says what it says. She was abducted, and the bloodline was invigorated, because what we find, that it wasn't Joseph who descended from the Anunnaki, from the royal bloodline. Joseph had probably the Hoover bloodline as well, so this too powerful thing. But Mary was descended from the patriarchs. The thing is, in this culture at the time, you do not put the women into the list of descendants. You put always the fathers. So at a moment, you find son of Eli, but Eli was the father of Mary. So there's a little bit of loop trick. And that's where we find it, that she, the patriarchs, it's from Mary, from the mother. That's why it's always transmit from mothers afterwards.
So we have that bloodline connection, and we have this kind of second coming involving Jesus that could be a fake second coming, that, you know, as Stuart Swordlight described, that the deep state has a plan for a fake second coming involving Jesus. Is there, now, others have talked about a second coming of Jesus, So I just wanted to know, with the cedars, with the return of the cedars, is there any truth to that? Is there a being among the cedars who is connected to Jesus, whether by bloodline, whether a soul connection? Some people talk about Sananda. So is this Sananda real or not?
Of what I know, Sananda, I have been told that is a made-up, that there's a character that existed, but it has been used as a cover to pass a narrative. What I know is that I haven't been told about Jesus himself, his soul coming back. I haven't been told Jesus, the guy, is going to come back. Neither Thorhan, neither the Galactic Federation of Worlds, neither the Cedars have told me such a thing. But, Michael, you mentioned Jesus or someone carrying his blood would be back. I know. Enki is back, and he carries the same blood. So would it be that? And Enki terrorized, Enki is coming back, terrorizes a lot of people who don't want that.
Well, that is a very interesting connection. So just before we kind of like address Enki in more focus, and I bring him into focus, into the discussion. So just to be clear then, with Jesus and the second coming, that is part of this contrived second coming that the deep state or the Endel faction wants to manufacture to fool people. Okay, so this takes me to a warning you received from one of the groups that you work with, the Amurtha extraterrestrials, saying that they warned you that the Nebu will return to the Fertile Crescent in a second coming. So what does that mean?
Well, yeah, this wasn't delivered to me, actually. It was delivered to some military people who saw that from the Randallsham Forest incident. There were binary codes, actually, with four types of symbols that were saying something that, Linda Moulton Howe studied this case, and that's how I came across this. And I went, oh, that really, really matches with the messages that I have to warn people of the Nebu who try to come back. They say clearly the word Nebu, that's what attracted my attention. So the Imurtha, who are they? They are part of the Council of Five. They are benevolent beings. They look like greys, tall greys, but they are part of the Council of Five. They are good. And they warn these militaries that the Nebu, be careful, the Nebu are going to try to come back. And they are tricky. And they spoke by codes. And one code was Trojan horse. And so that matched exactly the messages I got from a person's name was Ardana, who is in the Galactic Federation of Worlds, who said, tell them that the Nebu, even if we have chased them from your star system, they are trying to come back and they are trying to trick everyone by hybrids. And that really matched the message that I had. So I found it significant to mention it in my book.
Well, this is, you don't address this in the, well, you know, this follows from this warning, I guess. Is the Islamic world believes that a Mahdi will return, and that this Mahdi will return and he will start to cleanse the world of impurity, wrong beliefs, and then he would be followed by the return of Jesus. And that would all be part of the final judgment, which is one of the Islamic pillars. So is this, you know, part of what that warning was about the Fertile Crescent and the Second Coming?
Yes, I think that matches, because it's the same part of the world. And, you know, there's always this coming back of the gods that is always there in all religions, and that come at the last moment for the reveal and to just eradicate the demons. But there is also, you know, there's a double narrative. There is also the organized religions who passed this narrative, just plugged it in, that someone is coming back as well. It's someone different. And this one is going to be tricky, but and will be like the savior. Every time you hear savior, someone who comes to save everyone, it's wrong. It's not the good it is. The good it is are not here to save us, but to assist us saving ourselves, to empower us, give us the technology and means that we do it. When there is savior narrative, that comes from the organized religions.
Yeah, that's a very important point, because I know that there are scholars like Paul Wallace, mm-hmm. and Mauro Bellino, who talk about how the original plurality of gods or beings, Elohim — they describe them as Elohim, but it's the same thing as gods, the creator gods — that was all distilled or changed in organized religions into this one God, this Yahweh character, and that was a manipulation. And so now the indigenous religions were correct, the indigenous cultures were correct about the return of the creative gods, because they're talking about the cedars, but the organized religions hijacked that and turned it into a monotheistic, all-powerful monotheistic god like Yahweh, and then contrived this kind of return, this second coming around that figure, and they've kind of — that's how they want to do the manipulation.
Yes.
So it seems to me that this is really the way in which the return of the cedars has been hijacked into this organized religion narrative of a second coming.
It's always the same ways of doing, Michael. When you cannot destroy the message or destroy the fact, when there's nothing you can do about something that's going to happen, well, because even if you destroyed it, it would empower the message. So the last and unique option you have is to corrupt by flooding the world with misinformation that is about the same topic, or just putting another made-up narrative on the top of it to wrap it in something that really looks alike but is slightly different. But the slight difference makes a big difference.
That's very important, because that's exactly what Paul Wallace and Mauro Bellino say, that it was just changing a few words from the original meaning, talking about a plurality of the Elohim, to this all-powerful monotheistic God, and that was actually changed because of these organized religious figures that were behind it.
Yes.
So, you know, you've already mentioned that this all-powerful God, you know, if we're talking about Yahweh or someone else, is no one else, is actually Enlil in disguise. You've already kind of mentioned that. So this kind of takes me to a controversy which has recently emerged, and it seemed to be that this controversy emerged after you had announced that you had actually met with Enki. That Enki has returned. So maybe firstly, just explain the return of Enki. We know that in October of 2021, the Cedars return. So when did Enki return, and then when did you actually get to meet him?
Well, he returned probably end of the summer, in the summer 2021, because early September 2021, he manifested to me, he made contact with me. It was a very life-changing event because I was very impressed. You know, that's not something that happens in a million lives. And he said that he was back. He was back to see his children rise and free themselves from slavery. And he was back to assist them and bring a gift, which I knew about it later. So that happened in September 2021. He was just back. So he may have been back in the summer. So that's when I met him. You know, Michael, Enki and Lili and Unaki has always fascinated our cultures and our societies. And, you know, there's a lot of books been written about it, a lot of videos and people but talking about it. But it was like we were talking about other stuff, like the pyramids and, you know. And it was part of the great mysteries of the past of humanity, the ancient astronauts' theories, and, you know, but it, at the moment, I said, I met Enki. Things changed. Suddenly, everyone was talking about him in negative. Suddenly, there was a mission to discredit Enki. Not me. It's all aimed at Enki. And this is quite incredible to observe that there is, since the moment I have announced it, that the dark ones freaked out. It really did, and they are, because they are not happy that he's back, because he's bringing something to help us and to empower us. That is quite remarkable.
Well, I think that this is very interesting that soon after you began talking about Enki returning, and then you talk about meeting Enki several times, and that's in your book, in the Cedars, so that's very significant that you discuss that all of these narratives just popped out of nowhere, saying that Enki was evil and that he was here as part of a deceptive agenda. And that was kind of really puzzling to me, because it has actually no basis in fact or in history. Because when you look at the historical texts of the Sumerian texts, it's like, you know, the Atrahasis, for example, or the Enuma Elish, or the Eridu Genesis. You know, these texts, that these all describe Enki as being the positive Anunnaki that had created humans and that actually protected humans and prevented them from being wiped out during the Great Flood. And that was Enlil that was trying to wipe out humanity. Now, all of a sudden, we have these narratives from people saying, well, you know, I'm channeling creator source, or I'm getting a download, and Enki is evil and Enlil is the good guy. And it's just like, well, you know, what's the historical fact here? I mean, you're just using subjective sources, which is, you know, your alleged channeling with divine creator. Maybe these people are good some of the time. You know, maybe your downloads are good some of the time. But if you suddenly start using that as a kind of infallible absolute source, I have to say, well, I'm sorry, you're deluded. The historical texts are quite clear. Enki was the positive Anunnaki scientist that played a role in humanity's creation and protecting humanity. And Enlil was the one that wanted humans to just be slaves. And then when he didn't get his way, he just wanted to wipe them out. That's historical facts. So, you know, these historical revisionist attempts by these people, I mean, to me, I look at it all and the way it's all coordinated, and I say, well, this is a psyop. This is a psyop, and it's directed at the return of Enki, and I think it's directed at you.
Yes, because I happen to be his emissary at the moment, you know. But you know, Michael, you can kill the emissary, you can't stop the message. But what I want to say, it's very simple. Go back to the ancient text, and what all the ancient texts say, that Enki was a geneticist, okay? They never say Enlil was a geneticist. Enki was a geneticist. His name, Ea, means water. He's linked to water, the waters of creation, the liquid of the womb, the amniotic gel in which the fetuses are grown, you know. That's who he is. And that's undeniable. All the ancient texts say that. Now, what the ancient texts say as well, but not only in Sumer, in a lot of other cultures, that a geneticist, a creator of humanity, had done such a good job, and he empowered them. We have the tree of knowledge with the apple of knowledge, you know. He gave back to humans, he activated a potential, okay? But then there was someone else with Enlil who wasn't happy with that and wanted to wipe out humanity and take away from them their hopes, their strength, their, you know, and they want to take them, Enlil wants to take them down. So there's a geneticist who can enhance humans, and there's another one who's not happy with that and wants to destroy all the humans because he wants humans only as slaves. That's as simple as that.
There was a book written in 2013 by an author, Maximilian Lafayette, and the title of that book was 2022, What Will Happen to Us When the Anunnaki Return to Earth in 2022? So that was written nearly 10 years ago by Maximilian Lafayette, and you know, I've had a little bit to do with him. I've communicated with him in the past, and I always felt that that was kind of almost like a pseudonym for a group of people associated with the military intelligence community. So what that tells me is that back in 2013, Lafayette and the military intelligence community knew that the Anunnaki would return at this time in 2022, and we're right in the middle of that. So they knew that he would return. So that means that the military intelligence community and the bloodline families knew this. And so they had plenty of time to prepare their plans, whether they were to kind of like accept the Anunnaki and Enki, or whether to oppose them, and whether to, as we're seeing right now, kind of like defame Enki and try and rewrite history and make him out to be the evil Anunnaki returning. To me, this book shows that the military intelligence community knew that the Anunnaki were returning, and we are right in the middle of this. And the same power struggle between the Enlil faction and the Enki faction is occurring right now.
Yes, and I can really observe that. You know, when these people act by fear, because if they knew that, it's because they have, I believe, time looking or looking glass devices. These people know what may happen. And there's also all these ancient predictions from all the myths. The good ones are coming back. It's Intergalactic Confederation, it's Enlil and his to celebrate the liberation of humanity. Enki loved humanity. He saw the potential. He's a scientist. He's all about, excited about finding stuff, you know, and the finding out of who the humans of Earth are. He couldn't stand to know them being used as slaves. That wasn't right. Not these ones, you know. So he's been fighting for that. And now he's coming back because he's happy, because we are setting ourselves free, and then he can bring something that will not fall in the wrong hands, and this thing will heal. All the alterations that have been made on the human genome, on locking the strands of DNA, or locking everything to maintain us as dumb and slaves, he's bringing something to repair that. And the Dark Ones, the Enlil faction, they certainly do not want this to happen. So they want people to think that anything that comes from Enki is evil. They try that. But, you know, I don't think it will work. It's just chatter.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of chatter out there trying to kind of poison the well, if you like. And I mean, that's very interesting. I mean, that gift that Enki is bringing back. I mean, when I read that in your book, The Cedars, I thought, wow, this is quite amazing. And that makes a lot of sense, that Enki did play the role of helping create modern humans with this incredible potential, that he would have the original DNA, if you like, or the Adamic DNA. That's and that this would be something that he could well bring back and help revert all of the alterations that have happened over many centuries of changes and poisoning of human DNA, or deprivation of human DNA.
Yes, and this is exactly the grail. He said it, he said the grail. What is the grail? Is the sacred blood of Christ, is the sacred blood of Enki's royal bloodline, is the Adamic DNA. And what Enki is bringing back, the grail, the blood of Jesus, his own blood, it's in fact the original moment when he changed, he hybridized himself, he put his own DNA into this primitive human. That moment, that's the template. And that's what he's bringing back, this genetic template. And at that moment, when he did that, the humans of Earth weren't altered in any ways. You know, the Anunnaki, after the Anunnaki started to, Enlil started to alter, and the reptilians and the greys, they all had their go with altering human DNAs down. But before all that happened, Enki had the purest template, and he kept it. And he brought it with him. Of course, the Intergalactic Confederation has it as well. And I found that very interesting, because I had the privilege to have 2 hours conversation with Enki. And I said to him, why is it you who are bringing it? Because I believe the Intergalactic Confederation, the Cedars group especially, has a database, where data bank, where there is the whole DNA of everything that is alive in many galaxies. So they surely have it. Why didn't they bring it back earlier? And Enki answered that to me. He said, for 2 reasons, because the Dark Ones in power need to be neutralized before. It's always the same story. Good technology, good thing must not fall into the wrong hands. But also because it's a great universal law. It's a circle closed. Anunnaki said, my people did it. So it needs to be my people who repairs it. So Enlil started the degradation of the human genome. Enki brings back the original Adamic DNA to repair this. So it's already being implemented in medical technology. They just wait that the Dark Ones on Earth are not in power anymore, that anyone who wishes so will be able to access to this technology and get this repair. It will not be done in one session, you know, has I've been explained, it's always genetic changes or repairs. It's progressive, not to be a shock to the humans and also the consciousness, because DNA is also embedded with a certain evolution of consciousness. So it will be available soon. And they don't want that, the dark ones.
Well, what's fascinating is that you described the cedars returning in 2021, Enki returning as well, as part of the positive faction, the scientific faction of the Anunnaki returning, and you're having meetings with them. And then you decide to write a book. And in January of 2022, you begin writing this book, The Cedars. And you had an experience with a CIA remote viewer. So tell us about that.
Yes, everyone has time-looking devices, the positive and the regressive groups on Earth and off-world. When I start to write my book, I decided I had all my notes from my contact with the Cedars and with Enki. And in early, after Christmas, in early 2022, I decided to, okay, now I'm putting all my notes together, and I officially, in my head, I told no one, starting to write this book. I told no one, okay? Well, you know, something is going to happen with this knowledge, because they knew this, the dark ones. What happened? At the moment I start, maybe a week or two later, I just started writing. In the middle of the night, I was awakened by all my protections, like ringing, there's something that tries to get at you. And there was a vortex opening in front of me, and I could see someone remote viewing me. And this, it was very, very impressive. It was a man in his 40s. He was sat at a desk, and he was looking at a very old-looking, huge, huge computer. He was looking at something, concentrating on something on the screen, but he was open this remote viewing to me. And I knew the target. The target was, what is she writing about? What is she writing about? And he looked like from maybe 1940s or 50s. He had a short sleeve shirt, brown with a black tie, hair very neat and gel. I had this impression he was from a past. Maybe it was made up to make me believe it was from the past, but I believe so. I had really this impression, and the word came, the three letters that you mentioned. And that was very vivid. And then, well, I have protections that destroyed the vortex and just closed it. But I was impressed. Someone knew. They knew I was going to write this book. So they had to know what I was writing about. That was important. Why were they so focused to know what I was writing about? Well, I had my answer when I started to speak about what I was writing about publicly. The few hints I gave, I'm writing a book, it will be about the Cedars, yeah, whatever. I met Enki. Oh. That's suddenly, oh, that's it. We are going to try to destroy this narrative. And that's why they wanted to know, to prepare, I believe, a counter-narrative on what I was going to write. But now that the book is out, well, this knowledge is public. There's nothing they can do anymore.
It's very interesting that you had that remote viewing incident involving someone from that CIA, yes, and that you identified him back then. And yes. Yeah, a lot of this counter narrative you've been talking about, that does trace back to the CIA. I mean, some of the people that are putting out the counter narrative are former CIA. So it's not an accident that they're kind of like giving a platform for these people attacking you personally, attacking Enki, and trying to rewrite our history. But, you know, the history is, it's been there for thousands of years. Enki is the positive Anunnaki that tried to assist humanity, and that those that are now trying to reverse that, you've got to look at them and say, well, why are you trying to rewrite history? There's no, what's the evidence? And, you know, you can't just say, well, you know, I'm channeling source energy, or yes, I got a download this morning and it's telling me this. It's, no, that's subjective. What is concrete evidence? Because the Atrahasis, Unuma Elish, these are the historical records that were transcribed from the oral traditions by people who venerated these stories. They did not change one bit of that information because it was so sacred to them. And the important thing was, the Sumerians lived through this. They interacted with the Anunnaki. You know, the Anunnaki openly interacted with humanity at that time. So if we want to know what the Anunnaki are like, we've got to listen to what the Sumerians had to say. Don't listen to someone channeling, you know, vague sources or making all these claims, you know, when you have the historical records right there. I mean, one book I can refer people to is Matthew LaCroix, who is an excellent scholar, who wrote a book, I think it's called The Stage of Time, The Stage of Time by Matthew LaCroix. If you wanted to get an impartial, third-party, independent perspective on this whole Enlil Enki thing, don't just think it's Elena's, you know, Enki's emissary, and Sala's, you know, hoodwinked by Elena, and he's kind of like, you know, besmirched by her or somehow, and you know, he's lost all objectivity. Look at Matthew LaCroix. Look at his book, The Stage of Time. It is a really an excellent investigation of the Anunnaki, and it describes quite clearly this struggle between the Enlil Eagle faction and the Enki serpent faction, that were the positive faction. And LaCroix does a masterful job in just laying it out quite clearly. So I recommend people go to that, and you'll see Elena is absolutely right. Enki is the positive one here to help. So, I mean, we've gone kind of like quite a bit of time. So do you want to kind of like maybe raise anything about the book that we haven't covered yet, or anything that you'll kind of want to bring up?
There is something, there's a spiritual dimension to that is underlying throughout the book, which is, who are we? And I received an understanding of the planetary matrix, who we are as a soul coming from source, the journey incarnating on different worlds, and that all follows a pattern and a law of the universe. And this vision, this explanation, I describe it in my book throughout everything that happens. And it is especially, in fact, this book is about retrieving our memory, the memory of humanity. And throughout retrieving the memory of humanity, retrieving our power, taking back our power again, because knowledge is power. And once we know we are, and Enki is there for that, once we know we are, nothing can destroy us because we know our power. And I'm a very intuitive person. And also, although I really try to substantiate all my claims by archaeology and history and traditions, I did a bit of research on that. I also work by intuition and heart. And when I met Enki, there was no doubt. It just blew my soul away with love. This person loves humanity. And when someone just comes from the heart, cannot be a bad person. And that is something really important. And I entice people to follow this example if they want so. Always, facts are the facts. Look at the facts first. History, the records, what's undeniable. Facts are undeniable. But also, work your heart. What does your heart tell you? And when something comes to disempower you, it's not coming from the place of the heart, from the good place. All the narratives that are made, created, and really built to keep you enslaved will be the narratives who will bind you in fear, something is coming, or you're going to be saved, that takes your power away. Everything, it's leave it. What empowers you? What gives you your power back? That's real. So that is what my book is also about.
Well, thank you, Elena, for your dedication in getting this information out, despite really a lot of attacks on you personally. I mean, I've seen these attacks and I know the effect it's had on you, but you've kind of like bravely continued forward, and you haven't kind of like put yourself in the gutter with these people that are doing these really mean-spirited attacks. And so I really kind of admire you for that, and staying positive, staying on that hard, on that high ground, and really just laying out this positive future that we have, and that Enki is part of that incredible future that waits for us. That is something, if people open themselves up to that, you can really step into your full power. So where do people get a copy of The Seeders?
Well, you can go on my website, elenadanan.org, and my page, author. You have all the different links, but it will be available first from today on Amazon. Amazon is the easiest way to get everything out as fast as possible. So Amazon or my website.
Well, thank you, Elena, for coming back to Exopolitics today.
Thank you, Michael. And I honor your mission and your dedication as well.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Exopolitics today with Dr. Michael Sala. Please remember to like, share, and subscribe to this channel. Join or start a conversation in the comments. Take the time to explore the vast library of best-selling books, webinars, and podcasts by Dr. Sala. Visit exopoliticstoday.com.